The Capital Investment Committee meeting for today will come to order. And the clerk will note the roll, and there is a quorum, so we can begin. And we're going to continue with the excellent reports that we've had from the past, and Mr. Wally has offered to tell what his favorite 20th century projects were in bonding bill. He's been around a long time, and he's been to many parts of the state. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Wally.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Tell us your story.
All right. My name is Kevin Wally. I'm with the Freiberger Law Firm, and I represent the City of Duluth and some other clients, and we've had the opportunity to work with the Capital Investment Committee over the course of many years on a number of projects. But I'm going to focus on one particular project that has had a particular impact on a community. It's the City of Duluth. And the story I'm going to tell is how public sector capital investments can transform a community. And the story is the evolution of the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center. And the story starts back in the early 60s. You have a picture here on the screen of what the City of Duluth downtown looked like. That photograph is focusing on the property where the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center is now located. It was the Zolk Joseph Scrapyard, where they prepared scrap metal for loading onto ships that were going to go down to the steel mills in Erie, Pennsylvania, Cleveland, Ohio, Gary, Indiana. And so right in the heart of the city, the first impression that you got of Duluth was a scrapyard on the water. And community leaders started a planning process because at that same time, some of their public facilities were really wearing down. The Duluth Curling Club was really not a tremendous venue for UMD hockey, for example. For entertainment that would come through town, it was the old Duluth Armory out on London Road, and it too was running down, and you know, it was in bad shape. And so they, the community leaders got together and decided to do a planning process, and they came up with the idea of developing the Duluth Arena Auditorium. And the city issued bonds to the tune of $3.1 million, and they secured a federal grant for $3 million. And the first phase of the project was built without state support, but with leadership from a number of the area legislators at the time. So I'll show you another picture. Here's the same site on a sunnier day. The sunny day doesn't really help it that much. But one of the decisions they had to make was whether to build the new arena auditorium over the hill or downtown. And it became clear that the downtown site would be preferable because it would have the added benefit of cleaning up what was kind of a bad first impression for the City of Duluth. They had their groundbreaking at the end of 1963. Representative Murphy, you probably recognize some of the people in the photograph. Some of them are dearly departed, but were leaders in the community.
They all men.
They weren't all men. I noticed that, too. Times have changed for the better, right?
Yes.
Yes.
In the whiteboard?
I've just got a few pictures here of the work in progress. This is the auditorium. This is the arena under construction. This is the arena as well. And that's the finished product as it stood in 1966 when it had its grand opening. And there was a tremendous outpouring of support for this from throughout the community. And I have a quote from an editorial that was from the Duluth News Tribune at the time, and talking about the community response to this change on the waterfront in Duluth. And the paper wrote, "Not for many decades, perhaps never in Duluth history, has there been such a genuine widespread enthusiasm over a civic achievement shared by so many people. There are hardly enough superlatives to describe the mood one can sense all over town. The Arena Auditorium not only extends a hello world greeting, but it signifies even more poignantly that this region has done something daring and magnificent to make itself a part of the broader world." I mean, the change in sentiment in the community was just tremendous. But they didn't stop there. in about the middle 70s, 10 years later. This is the arena. This is the auditorium. They're nice pictures, and that's the finished product again. They started construction on Pioneer Hall. And you can see the construction here on the left side of the screen. This is where the Curling Club is located, and they started having some success with bringing in conventions and conferences, trade shows. And so the footprint here that you see for Pioneer Hall provided some extra exhibit space as well. And that was also done without state support. That was locally driven. The place where the state support came in a big way was in the next step in the process, and that was the Cityside Convention Center. 1984, 1985, the city took its planning process seriously to try to expand on the opportunity for trade shows and conventions, and came to the legislature in the 1985 session and secured $16 million of state GO bonds to build the Cityside Convention Center, which I'll show you here in a moment. That's Pioneer Hall, sorry. Pioneer Hall, the urban. I'm just going to move fast through some of this stuff. This is the
because we're over.
Pardon me? Construction underway on the convention center. And here you can see the convention, the city center, Cityside Convention Center when it was opened in 1990. And this is... Then the city went ahead and did the Harborside Convention Center as well. This increased by half again the amount of space available for conventions. This has been a kind of the catalyst for change, not just on that site, but it provided the catalyst for updating Canal Park, where you've seen a growth of a lot of shops, restaurants, and hotels. You saw the Lake Superior Aquarium come into the site immediately adjacent and west of the convention center, then Bayfront Festival Park, now Pier B, and now Lot D is the next commercial development opportunity for the city. It's just down the way to the west. And so what you see here is an opportunity for that a city sees to make a fundamental change with a major public capital investment. And that provided the catalyst for what we now know as the downtown area of Duluth, Canal Park, that whole region, which has been a great growth experience for not just the community and its tax base, but for the whole state in terms of the welcoming way that Duluth now can host conventions, concerts, and other events. So I just wanted to tell you the story of the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center. It's a great success story. The state has been a tremendous partner at different turns in this process. And so we'd like to thank you for that, of course. There's also a much longer list of city projects that we could talk about, but I wanted to keep it focused on this one instance of having the major capital investment be such an asset to a community. So thank you.
You mentioned GMD Hockey. Would you just quickly talk about that partnership with the university?
With the building of the Amsoil Arena, which is the latest improvement to the arena auditorium complex, University of Minnesota Duluth men's and women's hockey have a long-term lease for use of the hockey arena at Amsoil, and they're paying a rent, if you will, a lease payment on an ongoing basis to help sustain the operations of the facility.
Thank you. And so that's two entities that have had success through one, the vision to do the convention center, just like in Moorhead and the other places that have been mentioned for the convention centers for other regions in this state through these reports. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ms. Vang?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being a few minutes late today.
We know about snow.
Yes. since I was born during the last decade of the 20th century, I want to thank Jenny Nash for helping me on my research endeavor. So as I was looking through the research documents, the Earl Brown Heritage Center pop up a few times. And I figured I should go with that because you don't know Brooklyn Center until you know Earl Brown. Earl Brown was a farm boy who owned much of the land that's now quite a bit of Brooklyn Center. And he was a family man, a businessman, and a political figure. And fun fact, his mother, Jean, was made famous by becoming the first woman in Minnesota to be granted a divorce. Right? For all the right reasons, I assume. And he was also the Republican candidate running for governor against incumbent Floyd B. Olson at the time. And after his loss, he dedicated much of his time to his family and to the community. And his land often became the center of many community events, from Boy Scout trips to pancake breakfasts and cookouts. It was a place of gathering for many folks. And later, he donated his land to the U of M, in which the city decided to buy it back, and they changed his homestead to the economic center it is today, as an event hall and a conference center. And so his legacy continues to thrive on as a community leader and a place of welcome for many community events. In fact, it was also where I had my high school senior prom. Mm-hmm. And so that is my research presentation.
Thank you. Ms. Bang, I live in your district when I'm down here, and we're family of walkers, and going by there for many years has been, walking by there has been on our walking tour, and so I know of what you're speaking. And it seems like there's a lot of DNR meetings there sometimes, too. Which leads us into the next storyteller. Mr. Lacosmo, welcome. Sorry to not give you time to rest. Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Kent Lacosmo, the Director of Capital Investment for DNR. And as many of you may know, in 2011, DNR created this position to provide more of a focus on capital investment, both for the department and for the legislature. And so I'll address some historical perspective and some current looking at what bonding means both to Minnesotans and to their communities. And DNR has facilities in every county in the state. And we have a lot of stuff. We have $3 billion in assets, not including land. And many of these assets are WPA-built things, buildings, and or dams that we've taken over. So they're old. They need care and feeding. The program areas that I would address are that directly impact the quality of life in Minnesota. Recreation, obviously. Park development. Itasca Park was created in 1891. So with that, certainly there's lots of buildings up there, lots of things that people expect in their state parks. And also we support, you know, these other recreational aspects, fishing, hunting, camping. There was over 1 million campers that used state parks and forest campgrounds in 2016. Boating, biking, mountain biking, cross-country skiing, all those types of activities occur on state lands. We also have activities that support industry, the forest industry. There was a little discussion earlier about how bonding was used for reforestation, and there's also been recent bonding for urban forests and dealing with ash borers and Dutch elm in the past. Mining also, I think many of the committees have stopped at the Drill Corps Library in Hibbing, which is, we have a requirement to store the cores that exploratory drilling. We have 3 million lineal feet of core in that library now, and it's running out of room. It needs to be expanded. That's enough core to stretch from here to Chicago, if you want to put a perspective on 3 million feet. The other programs that we have dam safety. There's 311 dams in the state that are owned by the state, and there's another 400 some that are owned by local governments. So we have a program that obviously protects, that we have to do to protect and keep the state-owned dams functioning. These are dams, some of them are high hazard, that certainly if there's a failure, there's loss of life or significant property damage. The others maintain lake levels on recreational lakes. So if the dam is out, there's certainly impacts to that. I mean, Lake Minnetonka has a dam. There's hundreds of those around the state. And last year, for example, we did an emergency repair on Collinwood Dam. It's a small dam in Meeker County, but it protects the, you know, without that, the lake would be lowered, you know, 6 or 7 feet. The so then also we do grants to local governments for their cost share grants for the repair of their dams. The largest one recently was dealing with the Lanesboro Dam, which is a high hazard dam that's owned by the city. The other major area that we focused on recently and that we've been dealing with forever, like I said, with the old buildings and state parks, would be asset preservation. And the definition of asset preservation for DNR was amended in, or created, I think, in 2009, and Representative Hansen was the chief author on that. And what that did was that changed from the typical asset preservation that you'll hear about from other agencies deals with buildings. Our asset preservation deals with all types of our assets, roads, bridges, water control structures, water sewer systems, and then, of course, buildings. So taking care of what we have has been a focus for DNR, at least, and a heavy focus in this last administration. And we, that's going to continue with the new administration, as I've talked with Commissioner Strohmeyer. And you in one of the first meetings were provided a spreadsheet by Andrew Lee, and that shows spending in most of, all of the areas since year 2000. Most of those areas, there was spending well before year 2000. And two programs then that I'll briefly highlight that have really made a difference to communities. Trails is one, and that's always been popular, and you'll see that on the spreadsheet. And that started in the 1980s, really. And then initially it was rails to trails, where we were buying rail right away and converting them to trails. And that Root River Trail, the Cicada Trail, were two of those. And certainly the Root River Trail transformed the city of Lanesboro. It's certainly, and most communities that we hear about now are interested in being another Lanesboro. And some of these trail communities have traveled down to Lanesboro to see what that has done and how that's functioned for them. Some of these trails, like the Root River and Cicada Trail, are over 25 years old, and they need to be maintained. We can't just build new trails. We also have to take care of what we have. And the Cicada Trail, as Representative Considine knows, was in very bad shape. People were going to ride on the highway instead of the trail because it was in such bad shape, or they were just staying away. So in 2018, we did the first segment of the reconstruction of that trail from about 7 miles from Madison Lake to Elysian, and we're doing design to complete the next section of it, so that would be fully reconstructed. And the design of trails has changed a little bit. It used to be just 8 feet wide, and now we're making them 10 feet wide, so it's a little bit wider. Reconstruction on these, you also have to look at all the crossings. Like I said, in the early rails to trails, when we took over those rail lines, we also took over a lot of old bridges that were 100 years old or more, and rail bridges are expensive to maintain. And often when we can, we'll convert a bridge to a culvert, so then you have it's easier to pave, it's easier to maintain in the long run. So trail development now is more challenging because we're dealing, instead of with one railroad owner getting the right of way, it's multiple owners, and not everybody is so agreeable, and we don't do condemnation to design the trail alignments. The other focus is on flood hazard mitigation, and the flood hazard mitigation program actually began in 1987, and there was a little bit of funding on that, but until 1997, when the East Grand Forks flood disaster occurred. That provided an emphasis for significantly more funding. And the flood risk has eliminated or completely reduced the risk in multiple communities around the state, from the East Grand Forks, Ada, Afton, there's funding. There's been Austin, Crookston, a lot in the Red River Valley, but that's where most of the repetitive loss communities were. But it has been throughout the state. The last session, there's money that went to Golden Valley, New Hope, that area, which has flooding problems. The Corps of Engineers has estimated flood control projects over the course of time has prevented $7.5 billion in damages in Minnesota. And the FEMA records show that $1 spent on mitigation yields $6 in benefits. So it's been a very cost-effective program. We've made significant strides in that. And for example, one of the areas that we're still funding has been in Moorhead from their recent floods in 2009, 10, and 11. But in 2009, they needed 2.5 million sandbags to provide their protection. For that same level of protection today, they need less than 10% of that, probably about 200,000 sandbags because of the significant investments that we've made. So in short, that's just a very quick synopsis of DNR programs, some past and some present, and we can provide more detail on anything you would like, Madam Chair.
I'm sure we'll hear more details as we progress in this session. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
What a good preview. Oh, Representative Considine, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No need ever to apologize to me. I just want to say thank you to the DNR and Kent in particular for getting that. Zacata Trail, actually, the rail is about a quarter mile outside my district, but it's kind of a secret almost. I don't think it gets lots of statewide attention, but it's 45 miles long, and there are several other places where you can continue another 20, 30 miles. Great flat trail. This is a little plug for the trails, actually. But again, thank you, and come on down and try it out.
Sounds good. I will have to come down and try it out. I don't have a trail.
I'm sorry to hear that, Madam Chair, and I'll take you to the ice cream place in Elysian if you come down.
Okay. I have an ice cream place. I have a candy store. I don't have a trail. But times are going to change. Ms. O'Connor, Mrs. Connor from Minnesota Management and Budget Office is been invited to come here because they have a secret that they don't want it to be a secret any longer. They want to provide information on how to apply for bonding money from the Capital Investment Committee to the state agency and to the committee as a whole. People have ideas that there's free money out there, Ms. Connor, and they don't have to do anything except to say, we need a. We need a. But we need directions on how to do it. And we're willing to share with the people of Minnesota our wisdom and knowledge. Thank you so much for coming. And are we all straight?
We may have a technical issue.
We do have handouts in your packets. In the meantime, Representative Lee? Representative Lee moves the minutes, that the minutes of the previous meeting be adopted as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are adopted as printed.
Thank you.
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Liz Connor. I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget. And today, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the capital budget process that local governments go through when they're seeking funding if they choose to begin the process with MMB. As you all know, there's a couple of ways local governments often go about seeking state support for their capital projects. In some cases, they work initially through MMB, and their requests get put into the publication that you all receive, and in some cases, the local government officials work directly with legislators. So I'm really here to talk about the process through MMB and the information that we collect and that we publish and the work that we do throughout the course of the capital budget process. And so to do that, I'm going to talk about some timelines and deadlines for the capital budget process, how local governments can apply, what MMB and other state agencies look for when we're looking at capital budget requests from local governments. And then I'll talk a bit about if a project is funded in the bonding bill, the obligations that come with that, and to serve as backup in answering some of the questions that I suspect will come to MMB. I have Jen Hassmer, Assistant Commissioner at MMB, who has expertise in that area. And then finally, I'll cover some resources and additional information that you all can share with your constituents as they're exploring the possibility of applying for capital funding. So the first question that we often get asked, and it's a really important question, is how are requests submitted and when do those requests need to come into MMB if they choose to work through our process? This is a preliminary timeline. We don't have firm dates yet, but this should provide a pretty good roadmap of the calendar for the 2020 capital budget cycle. In March through about May, MMB will be authorizing users of the capital budget system. CBS, the capital budget system, is a web-based application, and all users need to either be staff or local government officials. And then they can submit projects, request funding for those projects between May and June in the capital budget system. Then in June, MMB begins the site visits, the bonding tours that I think everyone is pretty familiar with. We do a lot of outreach throughout the summer and early fall, asking questions about projects, really understanding the scope of projects, who will be operating a facility, for example, if there is a request to build a new facility. So that's the stage where we really learn everything we can about the requests that are submitted to us. July 15th is a big day. That's the day that the initial capital budget requests are published. Those are the large books that members of this committee receive, and as I understand, it often serves as a springboard for bonding tours for you all. By mid-October, we require that local governments as well as state agencies finalize their requests in the capital budget system. That's the point where we need to know final costs, final project scope, and so forth, so that we can prepare materials for the governor's decision-making process. And then throughout the fall and winter, we work internally at MMB to do additional analysis. We meet with the governor, governor's staff, to go over projects, and ultimately on January 15th, the governor submits his capital budget proposal to the legislature. And then throughout session, as you know, there's a lot of discussion around projects, and hopefully we will have a bonding bill by May 18th, 2020, when the legislature adjourns. So that's a really high level calendar for this process, but as you can see, even though the bill doesn't get enacted until May 2020, the process really starts quite soon from our perspective.
Representative Salt.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. This appears to be the assumption that there's a two-year time lag every time, as if it's codified, and I don't believe that exists actually, and that budget requests and capital requests can be in off years. They can be a function of something that was in the system before, probably was a good project and everything, but didn't get. So I'm just, if you can speak to the question of Are we married to 2 years?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think yes and no is the answer. So the process that I've laid out is the process that is outlined in statute, but I think as you've acknowledged, the bonding process sort of is a constant process, and so requests might come up at any time, and I think the legislature and the governor, you know, certainly appear to want to be responsive to those requests that come up and the needs that emerge. But in terms of the process that I've laid out, that's really the cycle that's dictated in statute.
Thank you.
And Representative Salker, it's a timeline that I think we can find that this committee can work with better than instantaneous requests and requests that don't have at least the engineering and cost estimates in them. We can't just say about $2 million or about $50 million or about $1 billion, because we need to plan. Please continue. Representative Considine, excuse me, just a minute. Ms. Nelson, would you prefer that you continue on without questions, or do you want the questions as we go along?
Madam Chair, I'm flexible. Either way works fine for me.
Representative Considine. I'm learning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I don't have a question for the testifier, but following up, at some point, can we discuss that timeline and how things have been done in the past? I believe I mentioned to you that I'd like to at least explore the idea sometime that we do in the off year one a bill for asset preservation that would be separate from, because there are asset preservation demands and needs have grown exponentially, and I'd like to at least have that discussion at some point.
Yes, you can.
Thank you.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a really quick question. Just looking at the timeline, on July 15th, you talked about the fact that we get a book of all the requests. My question is, has that been winnowed down, or does that contain every single request that's come to MMB?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair and Representative, that contains every request that comes to MMB. We do, to some extent, maybe some refinement. If we catch that there is information missing, we try to fill in as much as we can, but we do not omit any requests.
Okay, thank you. Submitted. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, I just want to give a quick highlight of what the capital budget system is. It's a relatively new system. It opened in May of 2015 ahead of the 2016 capital budget cycle. And prior to that, local requests came to us on paper applications. So this really opens up the process to have it as a web-based application. The main requirement really is that all of the requests that come in must be entered at a sufficient level of detail. So we're meeting statutory requirements, and we're providing a level of information that is useful to all of you as decision makers. And as I mentioned in the previous slide, we anticipate opening up the capital budget system in early May of this year ahead of the 2020 capital budget cycle. And a final note on the capital budget system, we require that users are officials or staff of political subdivisions, which in statute is defined as school districts, counties, and cities.
Ms. Connor, so a small agency or could a small agency still apply in with paper?
Madam Chair, no, we don't accept the paper applications. We do provide a lot of technical assistance to folks as they're using this system. State agencies all have access to the system, but local users, just as a function of the secure firewall of that the system sits behind, we need to authorize all users. So we provide lots of assistance to local governments as they access the system.
So I suppose the township could go to their regional library and apply at the regional library computer.
Yes.
With help. Thank you. Go on.
Another question that we receive frequently is about which state agencies the local governments need to work with in this process. The first agency, as probably not coming as a surprise, is Minnesota Management and Budget. We provide instructions and forms about how the process works. Our role is really to collect and present capital budget information in a standard format from both state agencies and local governments that allows decision makers to have the full scope of what projects entail as the decision making process happens. We also calculate the cost of proposed bonding packages, as well as forecasting debt service cost of future bonding bills. And MMB assists with issues that arise after implementation. There are certainly instances where we need to provide either technical assistance or perhaps an appropriation in a prior year needs to be amended to better account for the work that needs to be done in a project. And I'll just say a word about the current forecast for bonding bills. The 2019 session, our forecast assumes there will be a $265 million bonding bill. And in 2020, our forecast assumes there is a $755 million bonding bill. And those numbers are based on a rolling 10-year average of the size of bonding bills that are enacted each year. So anything over that amount basically comes as a cost to the general fund. The Department of Administration is another agency, that has a pretty significant role in this process. Their responsibility is to review pre-design of projects before the design and subsequent phases of a project begin. They also monitor capital projects to ensure that they use sustainable building guidelines and that the building techniques that are used comply with certain statutory requirements. And overall, admin looks to make sure that projects are energy, cost, and resource efficient, and that the buildings that ultimately result from projects are healthy and adaptable and durable. Local governments also work with a granting agency. We cannot appropriate money directly to a local unit of government. That money has to flow through a state agency. And so depending on the type of project, a certain state agency is effectively assigned in the bonding bill to work as the granting agency for that local unit of government. And then in terms of what local governments submit to MMB and how we use that information, there's a lot of information that gets collected in the capital budget system. We require local governments to submit their requests by amount and in priority order if they have more than one request. They provide a brief summary as well as a very detailed description of the project scope. They explain the rationale for why their project is needed. They outline the rough timeline that they expect the project will play out. There's additional funding sources. As many members are familiar with, there is an expectation that local governments are cost participants in these projects, and so we ask to see what other sources of funding are coming in to support the project and whether those funds are committed or if they're pending and just hoped for at that point. We also ask that they answer questions indicating whether certain statutory requirements apply or don't apply to the projects, and there's a list of those requirements at the end of the presentation. And finally, we require that resolutions are submitted by the governing body of political jurisdictions, really to back up the request that's being made to indicate that it is a priority for the city or the county or school district. And then in terms of how that information gets published, the big books that you all will receive in July, each local government's requests are basically laid out in this order. There is an initial project summary, which acts as a sort of cover sheet for all of the projects that an entity might be requesting. They're listed in priority order, and then the funding request that they have, perhaps if it's a phased project, they may have a request for more than just 2020. There's a project narrative for each request that outlines both a short description as well as a detailed description of the project scope. And then there's a project detail report for each request that includes all funding sources, all project costs, and the answers that they've provided to the various statutory requirements that can apply to capital projects. MMB takes all of the information that is submitted and evaluates it, asks lots of questions, conducts site visits, and this is certainly not an exhaustive list of the questions we ask, but I think it could be helpful for members to understand what MMB looks for when we look at these requests. First and foremost, we look to make sure that it's eligible for general obligation bond funding, meaning that it's publicly owned, publicly operated, serves a public purpose. Making sure that all the required information has been submitted in the capital budget system, understanding really the problem that the request is seeking to address, whether the project would serve a statewide or regionally significant purpose, if there's the 50% match coming from the local unit of government. We also look to see if the project might be better suited for funding through an existing statutory program at a state agency, whether the project might be able to be completed with non-state funds, if there might be a request coming down the line for additional state operating subsidies, and again, making sure that the project serves a public purpose and that the local government's elected leadership is behind it with their resolution of support. We also want to make sure that local governments are aware of the restrictions that are attached to receiving GO bond proceeds. Really, the process of receiving GO bond proceeds is rooted in the Constitution. It gives the state the authority to issue debt, and it requires that debt be issued to acquire and better public lands and buildings and other public improvements of a capital nature. So really, when we unpack what that means, MMB looks to make sure that the projects being requested serve a public purpose, that they are publicly owned, publicly operated, and the purpose of the bonds needs to be clearly set forth in law, and that's really where the enacting language in the bonding bill comes into play, making sure that the scope that's detailed in the bonding bill accurately reflects the activities that need to happen for a project. And finally, that those activities constitute capital expenditures and that they're able to use GO bonds to fund those various activities.
Representative Considine.
I don't have a question.
Oh. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think these guidelines are really great, and it's good for local governments to know them. Another scenario here, and I'm glad you mentioned the enacting language, because a lot of it is our responsibility as legislators, and of course the partisan and nonpartisan staff who draft these bills know all of these things. But you know, it's a little more simple, I think, than what you're outlining for us, because let's just say that Representative Considine gets a call from a mayor that he wants a bill draft, a bonding bill for such and such a project. Well, Representative Considine will talk to staff, and he'll get that bill drafted, and it's introduced, and we pass it. And then, you know, then it's done. The point I'm making is, you know, all of this is great to know, but, you know, from our standpoint, at the end of the day, it's just, you know, we get the request, we make sure it's drafted correctly, and we introduce it, and it becomes law.
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair.
Response?
Representative Erdahl, I think that's a great point to make sure that folks are aware that a lot of projects are really straightforward, and they're not They're not particularly complicated or questionable. The process that I'm outlining is really for local governments that want to come through MMB's process and to sort of, I guess, have that evaluation done to make sure that the state, the executive branch, has signed off on the fact that it's met the constitutional and statutory requirements for receiving general obligation bond funding. I think we've seen a relatively constant number of requests over the years come through to MMB, and some are more complicated than others. But I think you raise a fair point that, you know, there are certain projects that are, you know, really straightforward, that a local government might come directly to a legislator, and we implement those in the same way as projects that would come through us and eventually get enacted.
Yeah. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, thanks for helping me clarify that. But, of course, then we also have the situation where you're putting together a bonding bill, and some senator says at the end, with a couple hours left to the end of session, oh, just one more thing. And then you put that in and work on it.
Ms. Connor?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I think you're raising another important point about the potential pitfalls of legislation that gets enacted without maybe enough eyes on it to make sure that there aren't going to be any complications with implementation. In the 2018 bonding bill, there were certainly a handful of projects that had some trouble getting off the ground and will need to be addressed in the future in order for local governments to access the money. So there's really a wide spectrum of complexity and issues that can arise with the enacting language.
Thank you. I agree with that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps you're going to cover this later in your presentation, but there's always a certain number of cancellations. Can you describe the situations that bring us to the point where some of these bonds are canceled?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can speak at a really high level, but I think I'll ask Assistant Commissioner Hassemer to speak in more detail about the specific reasons that projects are canceled. Typically, you know, a bonding bill is enacted and provides sort of a four-year shelf life for bonds, and that in that time period, projects need to get off the ground, get money obligated, contracts signed, and if money is not obligated or spent within that four-year period, they would be subject to cancellation. And then MMB does outreach ahead of every cancellation report to sort of see where projects are, and if projects are not proceeding, if there's money that's approaching that four-year end date period, it would be subject to cancellation. And that can happen for various reasons. It might just be that projects come in under budget. It might be that the circumstances for a project didn't line up. Perhaps there wasn't the ability to acquire the property to move along with the project. So there's a lot of reasons for why that happens. Projects can come to the legislature to seek an extension beyond that 4 years so that there's additional time to get the project off the ground.
Is that okay? Okay. Are we going to get a list from is this committee going to get a list from MMB for that $265 or however million dollars it was that we have the bill will be used at? You said the bill will be.
Madam Chair, yes, the forecast,
yes.
You're referring to the forecast size of the bonding bill.
Yes.
That number is based on a rolling 10-year average of the sort of off-year bonding bills, and so that's the number that MMB and fiscal staff in the legislature have agreed to assume would be likely to pass in the 2019 session. So there's enough debt service currently held in our forecast to pass to enact a bill that's $265 million. If a bill was larger than that, it would come at an additional cost to the general fund to pay the additional debt service.
Right, but we had the total capacity you predicted as over $3 billion, right?
Madam Chair, yes. You're referring to our debt capacity forecast. And that is really a number that's derived from measuring the state's personal income against the debt that we have outstanding, against the debt that we have authorized, but maybe not yet sold. So it's a calculation that's done to just sort of measure our capacity for taking on additional debt. And so based on the debt capacity guidelines that have been jointly agreed upon over the years, I believe that number is $3.475 billion, is technically the largest bill we could enact while staying under our guidelines.
And I don't want to get a, I don't want to anticipate too much, or, but I want to be prepared, you know. So do you have a list then to present to the 2019 Capital Investment Committee members of things that you think should be in that $260 million?
Madam Chair, at this point, I do not. I think there's, you know, certain, we would probably look back to the projects that were already requested, but maybe not yet funded or not fully funded last session as sort of a starting point, and maybe looking at the needs that have emerged between when last year's bill was enacted and now, things that maybe weren't on our radar that should be considered.
So we have a lot of new members, and they don't know about any previous stuff, and so they kind of been putting together a list of their own. How does that compete then with MMB's list?
Madam Chair, MMB at this point doesn't have a list of what would comprise that $265 million. It's really just a number that's based on the size of bonding bills and not necessarily on the components of those bonding bills. So the projects that could comprise that $265 million could come from anywhere. They could have come from brand new requests. They could come from requests from last year that weren't funded.
Okay. Or from our list.
Yes, Madam Chair. Correct.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the last bullet point on this slide, that the project activities must constitute capital expenditures, I wanted to provide a bit of detail on what that really means. The question that we're trying to get at there is the project bondable? And so initially, there's sort of a high-level test that we apply to projects. We need to make sure that the asset is something that's long-lived. It needs to have a lifespan of at least 10 years, and that the asset must be fixed. So land, buildings, equipment, capital equipment, or other improvements to land and buildings. It can consist of the purchase of land, buildings, and easements, redesign and design, construction, major renovation, and furnishings, fixtures, and equipment are only bondable if those expenditures are incurred in conjunction with new construction or major renovation. So furniture and equipment all by itself would not be bondable. And this is not an...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that point, you know, when the Constitution was written, we didn't have computers, and even when we've amended it, it's a very different world. Should we consider amending the Constitution to allow for bonding or capital investment for computer hardware?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. I don't know that I have the answer to that question. I think that it's an important question to raise, to think about what sorts of things need to be built and improved now that are really critical and integral to the function of public services. I think that we at MMB look quite often to bond council opinions on what's bondable and what's not bondable. So I think looking at expanding what our definition is would be a really interesting conversation to have and would probably involve several different parties.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick follow-up. Do you know if other states, or would you be able to find out if other states provide for capital investment for electronic infrastructure?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm happy to look into that and get back to you.
Please go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also wanted to cover a few examples of things that are not bondable, that do not qualify as capital expenditures. And I think I've alluded to some of these things already, such as furnishings and fixtures and equipment. Studies are not bondable, then just evaluating then whether or not a capital project is needed. Any educational or promotional or marketing costs that might be incurred for a project that is not yet sited. Computer and financial modeling would not be a bondable cost. Master planning is not bondable. Relocation and moving, operating costs are not bondable. At this point, software and data systems are not bondable. And MMB always likes to flag that this is not an exhaustive list, but these are really the things that we probably see most often that we need to sort of raise the flag and say that they don't meet the test for capital expenditures. There are also restrictions on the use of property that is financed with GO bonds once it is built. And the concept that MMB is especially concerned about is private use. And that is really any direct or indirect use by a non-governmental person or entity. There are ways to allow private use to happen in a way that doesn't run afoul of federal tax law guidelines. And really to make sure that we're staying on the right side of federal tax law, we encourage local governments to work with MMB at the earliest opportunity in order to make sure that there are use agreements in place that allows the project to do the things that it needs to do while still protecting the tax-exempt status of the state's bonds. There's a very low threshold for private use as far as the IRS is concerned, and if $15 million of private use happens within a single bond issue, the entire tax-exempt status of that bond issue would be called into question, and the state would be potentially on the hook for additional costs. So it's a concept that MMB cares about very much to make sure that we're staying on the right side of federal law. Just a bit about the use contracts, the use agreements that I mentioned. It really is a lease, a management contract, some other kind of contract between the public owner of the property that was financed with bonds and then the other party that's maybe not the public entity that is operating it or using it. MMB needs to approve those use contracts, and so we ask that local governments work with MMB at the earliest opportunity to make sure that the use agreement is in place. Oops. And then this is a list of...
Excuse me. In other words, you're saying MMB has to approve of the nonprofit that has a lease with the owners.
Madam Chair, that's right. MMB would need to approve the agreement between the nonprofit, in your example, and the public owner before that contract can be confirmed. And then just a few examples of the things that we often see that rise to the level of concern of public private use. Skyboxes, concessions, naming rights, leases, airport terminals, parking garages where maybe fees are collected. Cell phone towers are another one. It's not an exhaustive list, and so we try to ask. That's part of the reason we ask lots of questions about projects, to make sure that we can surface any private use issues that might be at play in projects. There are some additional requirements that apply to local government projects. First and foremost, it's the grant agreement that's between that local government entity and the state agency to which the money gets appropriated. And those are required anytime money flows to a local unit of government. MMB has generic grant agreement forms, but some state agencies also have their own. And so those forms are slightly different depending on the agency administering the grant and depending on the funding source of the grant. The recipient of the recipient local government entity also has to have statutory authority or some sort of independent authority to operate the program to serve that public purpose in state bond finance property, because the bonding bill alone typically doesn't provide the authority for a public program to be carried out in bond finance property. And so first, making sure that the authority exists to operate the program. Grant recipients also must demonstrate to their granting agency that they have the ability to fund and continue planning for funding that program that's operated into the future. And if the facility is operated by a public entity, that local government needs to submit to their granting agency a budget item or some other demonstration that they have the operating support for it. If there is a use agreement in place, if there's a private entity operating a program out of state bond finance property, the granting agency needs to improve the initial plan, and then annually they need to review that plan to make sure that there is funding in place and will be going forward. There's also for local governments a full funding requirement, and this relates to that expectation that the local government comes to the table with 50% of the project costs. And MMB ensures that full funding is in place before we release the state appropriation. And so to meet that requirement, local governments work through MMB's debt management division, and they need to provide documentation that's acceptable that commits the dollars necessary to fully fund the project before the state's share of that project is released. And the concern there that we really have is making sure that the state hasn't put money into a project that doesn't get completed.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Connor. So, you know, it says that one of the things that are bondable is pre-design and design as part of it, but not master planning. There's a differentiation, and as someone who's worked in the field of master planning and pre-design, sometimes those areas blur a little bit. My question is if a city works with an entity where they create a city-owned property, which then leases back to that entity, and through the process, there's a lot of money expended in pre-design prior to the actual bonding, is that considered a reimbursement, or is it considered part of the actual project?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative, the answer to that question really depends on the enacting language in the bonding bill. There are some bonding appropriations that specify that the non-state match is met based on any expenditures that are incurred on or after such and such date. And so as long as that is specified in the legislation, those expenditures can count toward the non-state match. However, if that language is omitted, it becomes much more difficult to be able to count those earlier expenditures toward the non-state match, depending on the scope of the appropriation in law. So it's sort of a case-by-case evaluation. I'm happy, if you've got specific questions, I'm happy to discuss what those are. But my high-level answer would just be having that cover to specify that the match counts based on expenditures of an earlier date is generally the safest route to go.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Connor, the governor's working on his budget that he'll propose here soon. Will he also be proposing a bonding bill? And if so, do you anticipate that it'll be in that $265 million range?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding based on the public statements that the governor has made is that he is interested in pursuing a bonding bill this session. I don't believe there's been any commitment yet to the size of that bonding bill. And because we're in that off year, there isn't the statutory requirement to have a bonding bill from the governor by any certain date. So there's some flexibility there, but there's certainly been some public statements indicating his support for a bonding bill this session.
Ms. Connor, as you were explaining that, it was to answer representing, it's kind of a case-by-case decision-making by MMB. And what happens if, and you've said other things, is kind of like who they're talking to, or it's case-by-case basis on decisions. And I see that as a good thing, because everything's not written then. But what happens to it within the local government if they don't agree with the person that's telling them no, or that this can't be done? Who do they appeal to?
Madam Chair, I think depending on how long it takes to come to a resolution, you know, sometimes the resolution of last resort is to go back to the legislature to get the enacting language amended, and that's happened on a number of occasions to just iron out the problems that arise due to the language that gets enacted. Other times it just requires some additional, you know, conversations between MMB, the granting agency, and the local government to get additional documentation in place. So I think it really varies depending on the nature of the problem.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Connor, I'm struck by the notation, all financing must be in place to complete the project before the grant will be made available. So in a scenario where a State Department or agency has made a request and it is later determined that the request wasn't enough and the project cannot be completed unless additional money is included, would MMB approve of the initial request?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I think the situation that you might be referring to are occasions when the initial appropriation isn't sufficient to complete the project, and then that local government maybe has to come back to the legislature to seek an additional appropriation that, when added to the original appropriation, is then sufficient. If I'm understanding that correctly, I think those are situations that MMB, you know, has certainly seen in the past. I think Lake Zumbro, Lake Zumbro is an example. The Minnesota Museum of American Art is another example, where it takes maybe a couple appropriations once the full scope of the project is understood and the full scope of costs are understood to complete the project. And so at that point, once sufficient funding is secured, whether that's entirely from the state or between local commitments and the state appropriation, that's when the appropriation essentially comes off hold in the state's accounting system, and it's able to flow then to the local unit of government so that they can proceed with the project.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Ms. Connor. And I think that essentially answers my question. Therefore, if half the funding is available, but the project cannot be completed, and in fact shouldn't even be started until the full amount is in, that there would essentially be a hold on the funding from MMB.
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Connor, there's been quite a bit of conversation in the last few years about P3s, public-private partnerships. Is it possible to construct a bonding agreement that allows for a P3?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I think that it is possible. I think that that really depends on the funding source that's used. The Lewis and Clark project is an example where there was a non-governmental entity that was involved, and to complete that project, the state needed to use appropriation bonds. But My understanding, and I would defer to Assistant Commissioner Hassemer on this, is that there are some limitations on the state's ability to enter into those agreements from the federal government. So we would look to the federal government to make changes before we were able to respond to requests from public-private partnerships and use state bonds to finance those projects.
Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Connor, just jumping back to earlier in the presentation when you were talking about determining if a project is eligible for state bonding, I'm just curious, do MMB have evaluation of projects that have been passed and how they have met those criteria, or do you not have that information?
Ms. Connor.
Madam Chair, Representative, that evaluation happens, I guess, at a couple of points. The point that I'm involved in is the point where money is requested for a project, and so I can go back and look at some specific examples where we've maybe identified a portion of a project scope that isn't an allowable use of GO bonds, but yet maybe another portion of the project is. And so on my end, I have to do the work of separating out what we can use GO bonds for and versus what we can't within the request that gets submitted. Then there are times when after a bill is enacted where we see some needs in terms of completing a project that GO bonds can't be used for that we maybe weren't aware of. And so that's where MMB's debt management gets involved to help sort through that. And so we can look back and maybe find examples where we found things during the request process versus after enactment where we had to kind of separate out some of those non-bondable items from the scope of projects.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And sometimes there's a kind of following up on Representative Torkelson, there's a variety of funding sources that have deadlines. And so if you receive a federal grant and it has to start and you're coming to the legislature and asking for a bonding project for, I don't know, a state highway, and you don't get it and it's an imminent safety concern, so then the local government has to go forward. So you can't come again for bonding. You have to keep coming again and again and again for cash, and sometimes the legislature doesn't provide any of that. So then the local government is stuck paying for a state resource.
Ms. Connor, does that happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, I mean, we're aware of some cases where local governments have found themselves in that situation. The state is limited in terms of using GO bonds to help with those because, and this is grounded in federal tax law, that those bond proceeds can't be used to reimburse costs that were incurred prior to enactment. So that's certainly a limitation on the use of GO bonds. And then, as Representative Hansen alluded to, sometimes cash is not always available. And certainly when it comes to larger costs incurred by local governments, it's often difficult to find that amount of money to help cover the costs of local governments.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The full funding requirement, I think we've discussed in some detail, and just to give a bit more specificity around what that entails, the full funding requirement applies to the scope of the project in law in terms of what's enacted in the bill, and not necessarily the scope of the project if it's a multi-year, multi-phase project. So we really, if the bill has enacted funding for pre-design and design, that's the level of full funding that the state is looking at, not the full scope of construction, for example, that might proceed at a later date if that's not something that's included in the bill. There's a handful of slides here that I won't walk through in a lot of detail, but I think it can be helpful to give an idea of the number of statutory requirements that can apply to bonding projects. In some cases, that they may not apply. But these are all things that we hope local governments are familiar with when they request funding from us, because it helps avoid surprises after a project might be initiated, and then they find that they are on the hook for meeting certain statutory requirements. Things like using solar energy, notifying the legislature prior to proceeding with full construction, submitting pre-design to the Department of Administration, that the prevailing wage must be paid by the contractors working on the project, the full funding requirements that MMB looks for, hopefully seeing a 50% match from the local government itself. And then I would just offer this final slide. We have a frequently asked questions section on our website for local governments, and the web address is listed here. It provides a good starting point for local governments to familiarize themselves with the restrictions and obligations that come with receiving GO bonds. There's also links to the capital grants manual, some example grant agreements that local governments would potentially use if they receive funding in a bonding bill, as well as various sites for legal information, including bond council opinions, which is something that MMB looks to when we're navigating those especially tricky questions. And finally, contact information for myself. If you are working with local governments that are considering participating in the request process that will begin this spring, my colleague Judy Halla, as well as Jennifer Hassmer, work really closely with local governments after bonding bills are enacted to help facilitate solutions to the problems that can arise after enactment. So hopefully we've provided you a better sense of the process that MMB lays out for local governments and bonding, and I'm happy to answer any other questions that members may have.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Connor. And I appreciate the document with the slideshow on it, as well as the State of Minnesota Capital Grants Manual that that's provided in our packets that we can give to our local governments, too. Are there any further questions or comments that you'd like to make, Ms. Connor? Representative Salt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these both electronically available somewhere?
Madam Chair, Representative, the grants manual is electronically available on our website. There's a link to it on that last slide. The PowerPoint slide is, or the PowerPoint is basically a different version of the frequently asked questions. For anything that I'm happy to send an electronic version of the slideshow, but really the FAQ does basically provide the same content.
Thank you. Particularly the point is that small towns and or entities around the communities oftentimes start noodling about whether they want to get involved in something like this, and something like these packets can be very useful for them, so they're sort of working their way through and can conceptualize what the process will be. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is just for you to possibly just take back to the commissioner and some of the assistant commissioner as we start talking about bonding. I would really like to hear where the administration are at with regards to some of our hiring goals and how do that apply to our bonding projects going forward. And I think that's crucial for us as we invest in the state of Minnesota with some of our infrastructure that we actually invest in the workers and actually have equitable hiring practices with regards to some of our public projects, too.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Connor.
Thank
you very much. Representative South, would you like to tell us about a 20th century project in your district?
Madam Chair, I can. And I only preview this in that I took my sabbatical to get rid of Minnesota's other bug. I was not befallen by mosquitoes, but I got the flu bug, and so I was missing when I understand that Nels went through a project, and I understand it was that you covered mostly the flood project response stuff. Well, I know. I for everybody's benefit, I don't want to re-plow ground. That's useless activity. I'll run through
sometimes
some things.
It's good for the to turn the soil.
Yep. Okay, I think we've worked that analogy out enough. So I'm going to go through things that would fall into the area of an extension of Rochester and the community, the larger communities, one of its industries that a lot of people don't necessarily, and that is that there's a very intentional effort to work on the issue of bringing groups of people into the town to use some of the facilities we may have, which are a product of oftentimes state bonding, which then extends out. So, like, I've oftentimes been traveling around and been surprised to come across people that say, oh, yeah, we were down there with our kids playing soccer, or we were down there playing volleyball, or we were down there playing basketball in a basketball tournament, and I think swimming is another one I've heard directly. So, and as I went through those in my head, I'm also remembering that those are identified projects that have come through the bonding system. So I'll just highlight a couple of them. One is the National Volleyball Center, which is one that was built in the time period that my children were there, and so my daughters enjoyed the use of this incredible facility, and I will tell you that it is used. I drive by it all the time, so it's almost 24 hours a day during that cycle of whenever somebody could be thinking about volleyball, whether it's competitive interscholastic volleyball or if it's club volleyball, which is actually the one that uses most of the time, and then visiting tournaments that are put together. That goes along with then another facility that's there, which is our extended athletic complex down by RCTC, which includes soccer fields and an extension of that into the rest of the community. There are times when we have soccer going on all over the community, and it's people that have brought in their teams, their club teams, and all of that sort of thing. So, and these facilities don't just magically appear. I think we all know that in our towns of any size, we know that these large facilities like this oftentimes have to be coordinated in terms of their build and their function. Another facility is the Regional Sports Activity Center down by RCTC, which there's a bubble down there, which I would have been one of the first people that would have said, what and why do we need a bubble? But that bubble actually houses night senior softball up from about, I forget what time of night it is, it's something like 8 o'clock at night to midnight. Every day it's scheduled out while the bubble is up. So they've got these groups that come and use that bubble for something that's absolutely outside of what we would think. We think, oh, it's for big soccer teams that want to practice in the cold, or it's for football teams that are apparently practicing. No, it's nothing to do with that. It's the community with their activities that have actually locked the schedule up. I've talked to the administrator of the college and found that there's no such thing as open time in the bubble. It is all locked in with local people and their activities that I wouldn't have thought of. Senior softball, so that's my age, playing softball in an organized fashion and using that bubble. And so these products come, oftentimes these requests come to us, and we don't realize necessarily who all in the communities and the extended communities that are using these facilities. And so that's what I would bring up with that. There's one more I was going to highlight here, if I can just get myself to the right place in the notes. And part of that also was then the extension of the things that I'm sure that Nell's talked about, but and I'll just highlight it, and this goes to the replowing the ground. Rochester sits in a valley, and most people don't realize that all the water that comes to Rochester from the south comes off the hills and just flows right through this one space right by our hockey pavilion down there, and it, I would say it's about four blocks wide. So all water had to go through there. Well, in 1978, it didn't. And all of it backed up into the city and basically flooded the city in most of the parts, and I'm assuming he described that. If you can imagine that sort of thing happening, it was a big deal. And obviously the news reported it and all that, and we've spent millions of dollars, both federal and state, to bring that under control. To explain what under control means, when they got done, I think, and maybe Nels shared this, but there are about two or three residential properties left in town that have to buy flood insurance. So that's a very aggressive and yet successful application or change of the way water flows. At that storm, we had a 7-inch rain. Did you go down this road at all? Okay. So we had about a 7-inch rain. Since then, we've had three. I moved in 81, and so this all, the big thing happened in 78. So I was sort of listening and looking at pictures. Since then, we've had three rains in excess of 11 inches. So we'd had 11, 12, and I think something in the teens with no flooding. So what happened was this engineering of all these catch dams upstream from Rochester now stop even excessive water events that are way beyond the one that caused it. And so essentially what we have is we also now have a bunch of fishing holes that we can all go to. But primarily it stops the water flow from coming down to that one choke in the river, causing, if it were not there, we would have done about, about a 40% increase in flood damage properties, because the area, that flood area that flooded, is flat most of the way out, and it would have been larger and larger and larger from what it was in that occasion. So I would share those things, also letting you know that these projects in Rochester have brought us a new industry. So everybody knows that we have the Mayo Clinic there, and our hospitality gets full on Sunday night or Monday and empties out on Thursday because all of their appointments are done. But what happens is about Thursday, everybody's driving into Rochester with a trailer behind them carrying their soccer and their volleyball and their baseball and their all those kinds of things. And we have a whole new enlivenment of our weekend in Rochester. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You gave us good things to think about. This meeting is adjourned.